I plan to provide you with an overview of the value of partner services. I don't want to say partner services as they're typically practiced, because then I might offend one or more of you this early in my presentation. So I'm going to say partner services as they are stereotypically practiced, a rationale for revising the partner services guidelines, and a brief synopsis of the revision process. I've selected this slide to sort of begin my overview of the value of partner services because it really will help me sort of make some very salient points about partner services. Now, this slide is fairly busy and I don't plan on going through it in depth. Rather, I plan on just sort of directing your attention to the colored boxes because those allow me to make my key points. So this slide shows partner services data for HIV from North Carolina in 2001. And the first thing I'd like to direct your attention to is the fact that of approximately 1,500 partners elicited, about half had not previously been tested for HIV. What this signifies is that partner services provides us with an important means of finding individuals who are at high risk of infection and who are not being reached by other prevention interventions such as targeted or routine testing. In addition, I'd like to point out that of the 600 partners who had previously been tested for HIV, about two-thirds had previously tested positive for HIV. Now, we can't assume that all of these individuals were still engaging in risk behaviors. We don't know when those partners had had sexual or drug-sharing relations with the index patients. But we can assume that at least some of them were still struggling to change their risk behaviors. And so partner services allows us to reach individuals who are infected and are really struggling to change their risk behaviors in a manner that will allow them to decrease risk of transmitting their infection to others. Finally, from the boxes at the bottom that show the results of individuals who were tested through this through partner services, we can see that about 20% were found to be newly infected with HIV. So partner services is an important means of finding new cases of infection, whether of HIV or other bacterial or viral STDs. But in addition, you can see that there was a lot of high-risk negatives that were found through this study, and those individuals we know to be at very high risk, and we know to be worthy targets of intensive prevention services and efforts. So partner services allows us to reach high-risk individuals who really need our help. So those are some of the sort of close or specific values of partner services. Now I'd like to sort of take a step back and say, what are the overall sort of functions or values of partner services? And we can really group those into three categories. First of all, partner services is about service. For persons with STDs, including HIV, it helps them notify their partners and access services. For their partners, it helps them recognize their risk, learn their infection status, and access services. In addition, partner services fulfills an ethical function. It addresses the partner's right to know and take, if not infected, take measures to forego future infection. And if the person is infected, it helps them to access the medical care and or treatment they need to really improve their health. Finally, partner services has a public health function. Beyond just the sort of case finding and reaching high-risk individuals that the previous slide sort of indicated, partner services provides us with information that we can use to sort of target our prevention resources to reduce transmission in the community. Now, partner services is a term that sort of refers to an array of services that I think Matthew will describe in more detail. But it's important to sort of underscore the fact that partner services, while it refers to an array of services, will not be able to realize its full potential unless it's part of a more comprehensive prevention system. And other necessary elements of that system, in addition to partner services, includes other means of reaching individuals at risk, such as targeted and routine screening. There has to be access to and availability of clinical and psychosocial services. And we have to be able to deliver both behavioral interventions and educational messages and programs to the wider community. So partner services, while an important prevention intervention, will not reach its full potential unless it's part of that broader array. So now I'd like to sort of focus in on partner services. What are the key elements of this intervention? And we can really break those down into four sort of sequential steps. The first is that it's about identifying partner services candidates, i.e. index patients, individuals infected with STDs, including HIV. The second element is we need to contact those index patients and offer them partner services. And if they accept, we need to interview them about their partners, counsel them about risk reduction behaviors, and refer them to necessary services. The third element is to notify partners of their exposure. And the final element is to counsel those partners whom we locate, get them access to testing or provide it in the field, and refer them to other services, including medical treatment. Now, I'd like to sort of zero in on that third element, partner notification, because this is sort of the traditional core or heart of partner services. And there are four common approaches used for partner notification. The first is provider referral. And by provider, most typically that refers to a health department specialist, such as a DIS, or disease intervention specialist. However, non-health department providers could also provide this service. And by non-health department provider, I'm referring to individuals such as medical clinicians. Whoever the provider is, provider referral entails the provider taking responsibility for notifying the partners of index patients of their exposure to infection. Patient referral, by contrast, involves the index patient taking responsibility for notifying his or her partners of their exposure to infection. Contract referral is sort of an amalgamation of provider and patient referral. And what it is basically patient referral with provider referral as a backup. So the patient and the provider sort of agree upon a time frame within which the patient will attempt to contact his or her partners and notify them of their exposure to infection. If after that time frame is elapsed, one or more partners remain unnotified, then the provider has permission from the index patient to attempt to go find those partners and notify them. So it's the provider providing a sort of backstop or backup for the patient. And finally, dual referral involves the index patient and provider jointly notifying partners of their exposure to infection. Now, I'd like to sort of zero further in and sort of look more closely at provider and patient referral, because these are sort of the traditional or the big approaches in partner services. And provider referral is really sort of the classic STD approach. It's basically, I mean, some version of it has been used since the 1930s or 1940s when, you know, contact tracing was used for syphilis. And it has a lot of benefits. Now, before I describe the benefits, I would like to mention that whenever I use comparative terms in the next four slides, the comparison is between provider and patient referral. There just haven't been enough adequate studies to really make firm conclusions about the relative benefits or costs comparing, say, provider and contract referral or provider and dual referral. So, for example, when I say more partners are notified of their exposure under provider referral, I'm speaking relative to patient referral. So, benefits of provider referral. As I've already mentioned, more partners are notified of their exposure. In addition, partner notification is verifiable. It's more likely the partner will receive accurate information about his or her risk and referrals to services, and it protects the index patient's confidentiality. However, there are significant costs associated with this approach, most particularly economic costs. Provider referral is resource intensive, and the corollary of that is that we may only be able to reach a small proportion of newly diagnosed individuals if we insist upon provider referral and more money doesn't come into public health, which it probably won't. So it's important to note this, because provider referral has worked very well targeting syphilis prevention and elimination, but it may not be the best model when we look at other STDs such as chlamydia and gonorrhea, where the reported case number for chlamydia in 2007 is an estimated over 1 million, and the actual incidence may be approaching 2.8 million. Patient referral, by contrast, is often perceived as being better aligned with HIV programs' sort of emphasis on putting the clients first. That doesn't necessarily mean it is better aligned with HIV programs' interests, but it's perceived that way. And it has significant benefits itself. It helps the client develop disclosure skills, which is important in the context of a lifelong illness such as HIV. It's also less resource intensive for partner services programs, and that's important in an era of limited funds and budgets. And finally, the partner may be more comfortable being notified by someone he or she knows, as opposed to an unknown person from a government agency. However, there are costs associated with this approach too. Fewer partners are notified, the index patient loses his or her anonymity, and the index patient may not be able to answer, or may answer incorrectly, partner's questions. And I would like to really sort of emphasize this first cost, fewer partners are notified. We know that the 25% of HIV-infected individuals who are unaware of their infection status contribute disproportionately to ongoing transmission. We also know that approximately 40% of individuals diagnosed with HIV will proceed to AIDS within 1 year of that diagnosis. So if we use patient referral as our sort of model approach for HIV, we're really not going to have a chance to really change those numbers and get people aware of their infection earlier in their sort of disease trajectory or illness trajectory, and also sort of decreasing that bolus of individuals who are unaware of their infection status and so contributing to ongoing transmission. So the question is now, how are we doing with partner services? And to sort of get at this question, this slide shows data from a couple of surveys done by Matthew Golden and colleagues in 2003 and 2004. And what this chart shows is the four diseases that were sort of looked at in the survey. And for each disease, the percent of patients interviewed, when you take all newly diagnosed individuals across the surveyed jurisdictions. And so what that means is, for example, in the surveyed jurisdictions, approximately 90% of individuals newly diagnosed with syphilis were interviewed for partner services. So we're doing pretty well with respect to offering partner services for individuals diagnosed with syphilis. By contrast, though, approximately 52% of newly diagnosed individuals with HIV in these jurisdictions were interviewed for partner services. And in a subsequent survey that really focused more specifically on jurisdictions with high rates of AIDS cases, only 32% of infected individuals were interviewed for partner services. So we're not doing as well there. And then when you look at gonorrhea and chlamydia, in terms of percentages, we're really not doing very well. However, it's important to note that the incidence of chlamydia and gonorrhea in the surveyed jurisdictions was much higher than syphilis. So it's not necessarily fair to say, oh, we've interviewed 90% of syphilis cases, but 12% of chlamydia cases. Because in terms of absolute numbers, there are a lot more chlamydia cases were interviewed. Nonetheless, it's fair to say that there's been fairly poor uptake of partner services for HIV, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. And that was one of the reasons or sort of impetuses for revising the partner services guidelines. In addition, other factors that went into sort of CDC's considerations included the fact that heretofore we've had two sets of guidelines and two separate trainings for partner services. So the aim is with one set of guidelines, we're going to reduce duplications, we're going to reduce discrepancies, and hopefully sort of remove some of the confusion in the field for individuals who have, say, an individual infected with syphilis and HIV. I mean, how is a disease intervention specialist supposed to handle an individual with two infections when they have two separate sets of guidance for that same individual? In addition, there were emerging issues and methods that the partner services guidelines needed to address, such as partner notification via the internet and expedited partner therapy, or EPT. And finally, integration will allow us to improve services at the client level and realize economies of scale that should help us improve coverage. So briefly, what was the revision process for the guidelines? Well, CDC began by trying to really elicit input from a vast array of stakeholders by doing a variety of data gathering activities that I've sort of listed up here. And the sort of product of these efforts was a draft set of guidelines that we presented to consultants, over 70 consultants, at a consultation held in Atlanta, Georgia in November 2006. And these consultants included program managers and representatives of national programs, representatives from national organizations such as NASTAD, NCSD, UCHAPS, and CSTE, representatives from partner federal agencies such as HRSA and SAMHSA, subject matter experts, et cetera. And, you know, we were really looking for their sort of help, and what we got from them in the, at the consultation were really two messages. One, that draft needed significant revision. And two, they were not only willing to help, but really eager to help. The idea was, hey, we want to help you make these guidelines sort of speak to our reality and our needs. And CDC heard that message and sort of went through a whole new revision process. We began by assembling a steering committee that had representatives, again, from national agencies and national organizations. And this steering committee was sort of charged with overseeing the new second revision process, so to speak. The steering committee, in turn, convened 7 work groups comprised of both external stakeholders and internal CDC staff. And those 7 work groups were sort of charged with rewriting portions of the guidelines. Those work group sections were then assembled into a synthesized whole, and that new draft was sent to over 170 reviewers for evaluation and commentary. And again, the reviewers were subject matter experts, program consultants, program field experts, representatives from national agencies and organizations, et cetera, et cetera. And they sort of gave us our feedback, and we made further revisions based on that feedback. And I think the document has now gone through at least some levels of clearance, and Matthew will tell you about what hopefully will come out of that.